Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Well, and welcome back, and it is now or never. And I can only lay it out, folks. What's it going to take? There's a lot of things that we go through, and we've been going through content, and today's Feedback Friday, or at least it's not my normal content day. So Monday through Friday, I really want to help you. Over this year, I want to lay out all of the documents that you need to be apprised with. If you can't read them, then you need to listen so that you can hear us read them. And usually I have Paul, or I've had Eric in the past, and may have other people this year, but we're going to go through these documents, and we're going to be bringing out, and as a matter of fact, one of the things that I will tell you, when I do the ratification debates, because it takes so long to go through this. Now, we're talking about thousands of pages, and I don't read thousands of pages because that would take all year, easily, with 1 hour a year, especially with the editorializing. Now, if I actually just sat down and read it, you know, without any editorializing, we might be able to get that through. I don't know. It's a lot. Bottom line, what we want to do is lay out a curriculum, or at least something that you have that will help you understand what it took to create the Constitution, you know, the paradigm shifts and everything else that the framers kind of went through, the evolution of this process of creating a government that, when they decided to declare independence, they had no concept of this kind of government. And even after they created it, I'll just say not one of them really understood. I mean, many of them understood some details. And when I say many, they understood details. Madison understood the Constitution clearly the best. I mean, I think that his eyes were far more open than most of the other framers that were involved. Roger Sherman was another one. But it's a very exclusive club for those people that really understood the Constitution. I can tell you that they didn't fathom some parts of the Constitution to be actually the way they were done, makes it possible for us to use the Constitution as the foundation for a global government. They didn't think about that. They actually thought that, you know, and their paradigm was that the rest of the world was going to be hostile to them. But they may not have really understood that after a century or after a half a century, that empirical data would start proving how people living under the system would be far better. Their liberties would be far more secured under this system than under their current system that they're living in, whether that be, you know, a monarchy, a democracy, or what have you, that things just go better. And even though we had a lot of problems, and in all honesty, it wasn't until we got through the Civil War and, you know, turned our backs to slavery to where we really could, we had the capacity to fire on all cylinders, but we chose not to. There were too many people at the trough of power that chose to be petty and actually, you know, hold grudges and go down this path of, you know, we're going to stick it to these people. And that's exactly what ended up happening to the freemen. Now, you can call it insightful. You can kind of consider it divinely insightful of Thomas Jefferson in recognizing that repatriating freemen back to Africa might have been a more humane process because of, you know, the way our culture, by the manipulation of Britain, became so tarnished, or I should say it was indoctrinated or inculcated. It was just a part of our culture to have this racist vent or skew. I don't know what the better word for it is, but it was a prevailing part of our society, especially due to the illiteracy, or I should say the lack of education, as well as these baked in heretical biases. I mean, a lot of times we know for a fact that the babies are not born racist. We know that. And we know that that is learned. And so, I mean, there's no genetic code to actually get rid of racism. These things are learned, just like a lot of other things. But my point is that it took us a long time. It took this nation a long time to heal. I mean, when we went through the Martin Luther King speech, you know, for MLK Day, and, you know, we really need to get out of recognize. We have to get to a point now with, I think we've matured as a nation to recognize that we don't and we shouldn't be honoring our presidents, having President's Day. We shouldn't be honoring people. They're just men. You know, the fact that we have these monuments and these statues, it's nice to have these things for maybe historical purposes and having busts. I mean, I actually have busts of Madison and Jefferson and Washington. I even have one of Lincoln, but that was, you know, given to me, hereditary-wise. I inherited it. But anyway, because I would not have bought it, just so you know. But and actually, I have some Chia Pet, you know, busts. I mean, you know, some, because it was a good gag to have an Obama Chia Pet and to have a Hillary Chia Pet and so forth. And so I have some of those because people thought, you know, you got these busts. This will go in counter to that. And so those boxes are unopened, and maybe someday down, you know, after I die, my grandchildren will probably sell those things for millions of dollars as the truth finally comes out about these tyrants. But nevertheless, we didn't realize what we had, or I should say most of the people. And as a matter of fact, many people didn't even care. They tried to figure out how to create leverages, loopholes, and everything else to bypass the Constitution. And so I'm hoping by now everybody's starting to understand that this Constitution is a superior form of government because it won't lend to a theocracy. Most people, there's a lot of really good people, folks, that are really baked that we have to have a, you know, a Christian theocracy nation. No, we can. I think that there are other faiths that are copacetic, that, you know, I don't see the Jewish faith as a threat to liberty. I think that they work and they have these ways of undermining, and they do, you know, deals and, you know, backroom deals. I mean, everybody does that though, right? And so I see that there are a lot of faiths out there that don't, you know, are not a threat to liberty. But I see an ideology or a faith, godlessness, you know, what we call today secular, not Christian non-denominational, what we call secular, godless, because when they talked secular in the framers' days, that had no connotation towards godlessness. Secular back in their day was a what we called non-denominational, a Christian, you know, non-denominational Christian. And so we have to really start moving into the space that we understand that this Constitution protects us from, let's even say, noble people with good intent. There's people out there, oh, you know, I really mean to do the good thing. And you know, incorporating this particular Christian faith would be good. No, it wouldn't. The Constitution itself protects everybody's right for their own religious expression. Now, we have to get to a point where we say we want to caveat that we will not allow, you know, evil. So you have to be very specific. When you enumerate something, it's got to be very crystal clear so that it doesn't cause harm to somebody else. So over time, there's an evolutionary process. But I believe that Luciferianism and Satanism, anything that, you know, elevates and worships Satan, should not be allowed. We can't allow that. And that's something that would be left, you know, either to the states or to the U.S. Constitution to say communism, Luciferism, Satanism, and Islam. The documents of the Quran and the Hadiths have, I'll just say, evil philosophies, and they are a doctrine of compulsion. They are not compatible with liberty. When a doctrine tells you that you, once you've converted to this faith, that if you leave the faith, you must be punished by death, by beheading. To me, that is not individual liberty, nor does it embrace individual liberty and individual sovereignty. So we have to start looking at those things and saying, okay, so here's the problem that Islam has, you know, to become compatible with liberty. They actually have to change. So they need Allah to reveal through their modern prophet, because Muhammad's dead. You know, he's passed on, and how he wrote, that is the sacred, you know, document, and that's how they live. So until there is this, you know, a true prophet of Islam comes and actually says, everything we've taught you is wrong and so forth. But see, that's going to be a tough order, because that person would be challenged. If you look at how Muhammad, the only way he became Muhammad himself was through fighting battles. And he didn't win every battle. There's some pretty good books on this that, you know, go to the history of the development and Muhammad and so forth. But, and this isn't really anti-Islam. The fact is, it's just not compatible. I mean, we don't need to declare war against Islam. They've already declared war against every faith in the world, right? I mean, this isn't news to you. We know that they're at odds with the world and their, you know, are their religious faith, the world's religious faiths, whether it be godless, whether it be, you know, Hindu, Confucius, Christian, it doesn't matter. They're at odds and at war with the world, because the whole world must be converted. And they have to, and they have these policies that have to, I mean, if we actually sat down and said, you know, these are the reasons why you're just not compatible to be a citizen in this nation. You can't be here. And so, and we have, and if it's determined or it's disclosed that we actually have somebody in America that is an operative, in other words, they go to Christian faiths and everything else, and we find out that this person is an agent for Islam, then what do we do? You know, it's almost like deporting. They just can't be here. It's the same thing with agents for communism. Now, it's one thing to have an ambassador, and we all know that that person's an ambassador for, you know, an evil ideology like communism. So when we look at nations that embrace communism, i.e. China, Russia, and so forth, then, you know, we have to be on our guard. We understand that. And that's the same thing we have to do with at least Islam. But back to my point, you know, we've evolved to a point where we should be able to invite the whole world to enjoy liberty. That liberty is not, it was not ever, it was never the divine hand of providence, our creator, it was never his intent to restrict liberty to the soil right here on North America. And, oh, by the way, we're including the Hawaiian Islands and Alaska, you know, where these territories are, or these boundaries, this geographical points on the earth. There's no doubt in my mind that our creator wants all people to enjoy liberty. That's a part of the scriptures. And it invites everybody to be partakers of that. As a matter of fact, I think it's Leviticus. Proclaim liberty amongst all the land. Or, you know, anyway, it was on the Liberty Bell, that Leviticus scripture of proclaiming liberty. And so what we need to do is we need to get to that point where we understand that there are things that are counter to the Constitution. And so this show is not about religion at all. This show is about the party today. And so we're going to take this week, and unless, you know, I get some feedback, and I'll try to deal with the feedback quickly. And it's easier to probably deal with feedback when we do one-on-one. So if you want to call and you want to leave feedback, the phone number, it's a 202 number. It is on the website. Just go to Reclaiming the Republic and contact page, and it's right there. You just give us a call, and you can leave a message, and hopefully you don't have call blocking or what have you. So I can, if not, leave your name and number. I will call you back if it's really something that merits a conversation for Feedback Friday. That's the whole intent of having listener interfacing or listener feedback. I mean, the whole point is, you know, if you've got some things that you think are important, you want to share, by all means. But you need to, so there's, and I'm saying this because I haven't said this, but there's, I believe there's a gal, I think she's either in Kentucky or Tennessee. She's called and she's left some ideas and so forth. And I would much rather call her and actually have the conversation so that we can record that conversation and give you that feedback. She's come up with these suggestions and so forth of, you know, how to, you know, better interface with Congress and all of that. And I'm all for that. The problem is every time I've called her back, I can't leave a message and I don't have a text phone because she said she's called with a cell phone and her voice message is all filled, so I can't leave her a voice message. She says to just, you know, send a text. And so you're not giving me a good option. So if you're going to call and there's no other way to get back to you, then give me at least a time, a day of the week and time of the week that I or you're usually available, and I'll try to call you back at that time. If we can't work out any other way. If you don't hear back from me, then get back to me and say, hey, because I get back with everybody. There's not anybody that I don't reach back and talk and call. And those of you who have been listening to the show, that's how we've met and have started working together. That's how it is. I mean, every time I learned this from my mother. Only God knows how many apples are in a seed, in an apple seed. And so you never know how many, you know, how much impact you can have by engaging with a person. So I never not engage because I would be denying myself and that person the blessings and opportunities of, you know, being able to have a positive impact in their life. So I just can't be dismissive of that. I know there are a lot of people that are jaded that are completely dismissive, but I'm not one of them. So with that, the intent of this call, or to the intent call, I'm sorry, the intent of today's show is really for me, because you know I rail about the party, and I was looking back, and because the news has kind of indicated that Kari Lake had recorded a conversation with a party operative who apparently tried to bribe her not to run for Senate. And now that recording has dropped, and now everybody's running around and so forth. And just so you know, folks, there are states that have two-person consent laws. Now, that two-person consent laws are absolutely, I think, unconstitutional. And I say this because let's just say you have a real problem with somebody that is just absolutely, or an organization that they have a cultural problem. And when they say a cultural problem, you know, they're just absolutely mean, the way they treat everybody, they're just hostile. They're hostile towards, you know, your gender, your ethnicity, what have you. They're just hostile towards a demographic or what have you. Then as far as I'm concerned, using a private or a secret recording in a court of law, I get that. But using that recording, or actually not one recording, but a series of recordings with different people, then you should be able to bring that evidence, because now you have not just, you know, an outlier or a case, you actually make the case that there is a cultural problem with your store, with your organization. And when you have these hard laws that say you must have two-party consent and they'll come after you, as far as I'm concerned, if you use if secret recordings to actually prove a systemic problem within an organization, then, you know, that should be, you know, that should overrule that two-party consent. Because it's not like you're just trying to be nefarious and capturing somebody. You're actually going out of your way to prove to an organization that they got a cultural problem. And as far as I'm concerned, as long as these recordings aren't being used to actually milk somebody or extort money or something, because that's another reason why people use secret recordings to extort. As long as if you have a two-party consent and you actually can prove and you're not trying to extort or you're not trying to just sue somebody for money, then those should be admissible, into an open dialogue, whether that be not necessarily a court case, unless it gets to that point where, you know, it's not about a monetary gain. It is about identifying an organization that is absolutely hostile in our environment. Now, I truly believe that businesses, if they want to be racist, that's okay. But don't make everybody think you're not. You know, as a matter of fact, I think it's okay if you put out in the front of your business, you know, we only want to deal with white people. We don't want to deal with black people. I mean, I'll give you a good example. FUBU, you know, for us, by us, the clothing. And actually, I wasn't going to be doing this. I've used half my show on this. I want to talk about the party. But FUBU is a great example on the black side. And there are companies and organizations on the white side that are not representative. They're not diverse or what have you. But I think that's okay. And FUBU gets away with, and they're successful, right? I mean, they're a very successful clothing, at least they were. I have no idea. Maybe they got in trouble. I haven't seen their names, but they were pretty popular. But there's no doubt that was about their race. You know, and they were for us, by us, and that's how they wanted to operate. I think that's fine. You know, and anybody, regardless of your demographic, if you're willing to put all those things aside. But I believe that in America, we do try to, you know, use our dollars as a process of voting. I will support you by buying your product. I won't buy a product if somebody comes right out and says, we want to be racist. Okay, then that's fine. And that's how I function. But I think it's okay for businesses, folks. We have to allow that. I think it's okay for a business to say, we don't want to give homosexuals our business. That's not discriminatory. You have that right. As a matter of fact, there's an amendment going into the New York Constitution that they're trying to create a law that you cannot discriminate. And I'm saying that's absolutely wrong. If you want to discriminate as a business, you should be able to do that. But at least you have to be honest. You can't operate in the secrets, in the shadows that, you know, you are really, you know, a discriminatory business, and you don't want everybody to know because, you know, that would affect your business. It's not good for business to be discriminatory. So we're better off, you know, in working and flushing out discriminators, then we are creating a law that says you can't, because as far as I'm concerned, you have a constitutional right if you want to discriminate. If you want to say something insensitive and offend somebody, as long as you're not causing harm. And what I mean by that is you don't go into the theater and just yell fire. You're not on a plane, you know, when a plane is, you know, landing or something like that or taking off and you yell bomb. You know, I mean, it's okay if there's a bomb there, but it's not okay if you do it without cause and you cause public harm. You cause a panic. And so, you know, we've matured as a society. We've kind of played with these things to understand, you know, okay, you can yell bomb if you want, but you will be punished. You'll be held liable for lying, because along with the freedom of speech is the law of liability. As every constitution actually outlines the fact that you can say whatever you want, or print whatever you want, but you will be liable if it's salacious or if it's fraudulent or what have you. You can be held liable. So anyway, when we come back, we'll start the, because this is going to be a long dialogue. This is going to actually span over a few Fridays when we're talking about the parties and tyranny. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so anyway, I kind of wandered down a few rat holes already, but the whole point of today's call or today's message or show is really about the party system. Now, we have entities that are operating among us that are very problematic. Now, we have demographics, right? So what is a demographic? A demographic is typically a characteristic that is not necessarily controllable. Like when we look at demographics, your sexual orientation is not a demographic. That is a self-imposed thing. It's not standard. As a matter of fact, it's been proven it's not genetic. As a matter of fact, it was in the 2000s. So here's the revelation. As a matter of fact, I know I'm going to get feedback on this, so I want to be very clear. It was first laid out as a reason to, you know, stop people from saying negative things, because I'm not speaking negatively. I'm not calling for, you know, pulling people out to stoning them for their adultery or whatever. Okay. So, because, you know, an adulterer, is that not a sexual orientation? Anyway, the reason I'm saying demographics, I'm just using this as an example, is that when we look at, you know, these factors of demographics, it is really, you know, the genetics that you have no control over. I would say because I wear glasses, that there is a discrimination towards people that wear glasses. Not everybody wears glasses. And so when people scan the crowd, like when you're in a nightclub or what have you, and you're looking, oh, you know, who would I be interested in conversing with? Oh, well, that person wears glasses. I'm not going to talk to that person. I mean, there are people that actually look at those types of things. And because we're very judgmental, but that's not a standard demographic. A standard demographic is your race, your gender. It could be your culture. And so those are things that are, you know, outside of your control. Now, I'm going to say this because there has been evidence, and I want to actually look into this because I do talk about, you know, sexual orientation or deviations and so forth. And I've been talking to a doctor that has actually said, hey, you know, there is evidence that points to heavy metals and other things that have, you know, our diet that has driven us down this path of deviations. And I'm going, well, that's very interesting. I need to, you know, that's something I don't want to dismiss. So I don't want to be insensitive with, you know, some things that may be outside of our control, but it has been something that's manipulated. Because, folks, I'm telling you, this crap that they're spraying over our heads, You know, we actually have a state, New Hampshire, is the first state that is actually, that I am aware of, that has tried to legislate, and they're going about it wrong. They shouldn't be passing a law. New Hampshire actually needs to be, and if you know anybody that is a state legislator in the state of New Hampshire, you need to tell them that they need to talk to me because they're wrong in what they're doing. What they need to do is they need to go to the federal government and demand that every single one of those aircraft, because they're talking about air spraying overhead. Well, they're a small state. Theirs could be crap coming in from Canada. There could be crap that's floating, be the prevailing winds, that may be sprayed in Montana that work its way all the way over to hitting people in New Hampshire. The stuff that's going on over our head is absolutely unacceptable, and I'm glad that they're doing this, but they're going down the wrong tack. And as a matter of fact, they need to open up and start actually demanding full compliance. They need to start calling upon all the other states to do this. The problem is, in politics, everybody wants to work in vacuums, and they just do it for themselves. We're not organizing ourselves to demanding full compliance. This goes back to the party. This goes back to this whole paradigm that if the center of our political game is not the Constitution, then I have to ask you, what is it? What kind of agenda is the center of your political game if it's not compliance to the Constitution? Because what you are, if you actually have an agenda that wants to, you know, take advantage or create compromise that violates the Constitution, then you're the problem. And so the point is... that, you know, I did a show back in, I think it was October 2022. So it's been over a year since I've done this. But this is where I really dropped this bomb, that the ratcheting of tyranny in America really required a two-party mechanism to support and succeed the migration of the parties and tyranny in America. Now, we are also in an election year, and I have not said this yet, but I did say this last year. What kind of president does America really deserve? Because I can tell you, the dolt that we have in office, we didn't deserve that. That has been inflicted upon us, and that is actually an unconstitutional president. And if we want to actually be legal, we have to go back and undo everything that that dolt did. All of the money that was taken and all the money that was spent, we need to start fixing these things. We need to act, because bottom line, if this was happening in business and you realize you've been defrauded, you would go to the nth degree to undo all of the harm that was inflicted upon you. So one of the things that I also said, and I'm going to start off with this before I go down this, you know, my conclusions or I'll just say the history of the two-party system and how I can prove that they worked together to actually, you know, creating compromise to our demise and to actually, you know, weaken the Constitution to the point that it's at, it's in shreds. One thing that we really need to consider, because I like pushing the envelope and I actually like saying things that really, oh, you know, are you kidding me? I believe that the only human, the only creature that is a human being that should not have the freedom of speech are politicians. Because a politician, when they get out and they lie or they say something that, you know, and I'll give you a good case in point, Al Gore. Oh, the planet's got a fever. We're dying. You know, that idiot, he should be held accountable. As a matter of fact, when we look at what he was seeking to do, and he made these assertions by the year 2000, anytime somebody makes a prediction and they're a politician, then we need to go after them and we actually need to have them serve time. Now, like this Greta or whatever, this idiot kid has been, you know, basically using hyperbole we have to start, I believe that we really need to say, when you're making political comment and you become an influencer where people are actually listening, you're getting in front of politicians and speaking like you're some subject matter expert, then you need to be held accountable too. Because what these people are doing, this kind of goes down that Deuteronomy meme that I have. And actually, it's this is on my website. And so I would basically invite anybody to go to Reclaiming the Republic and the Take Action page. And at the very bottom, I have these political memes that we've set up, right? And one of these is the Deuteronomy chapter 19, verses 16 to 19. And this is what it says. If a false witness rises up against any man to testify against him that which is wrong. So in other words, let's think of this Greta. She's telling us that what we're doing with our cars and, you know, that, you know, this climate change, we're doing this. Then both the men between whom the controversy is shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges, which shall be in those days. And the judges shall make diligent inquisition. And behold, if the witness be a false witness and hath testified falsely against his brother, then shall ye do unto him as he had thought to have done unto his brother. So shalt thou put away this evil. Now, Greta has made hyperbole and said these things are going to happen. She put her, as far as I'm concerned, would you get out in front of the public and you're going to make an assertion on climate change, and this is going to happen if we do this, then when it comes to that point in time, oh, by the year 2020, you know, we're going to see the oceans rise, and it hasn't happened, then she needs to be held accountable for what she was trying to get us to do. In other words, she was trying to basically enslave us, you know, to take away our technology and everything else. She needs to be muted for the rest of her life. She should never be able to speak in front of a microphone. She should be excoriated and castigated as far as a influencer goes. She should have zero influence, and she should bear that for the rest of her life because she has defied the faith that we all, I mean, everybody has a right to get up and say what they need to say. But if you do it and you're making these, the way she made these assertions, she should be held accountable, folks. We as a society need to put away this evil because we see this. This happens in races. How many times have we seen, you know, they get so desperate because there's somebody that might be actually a good senator. I think this happened in Alabama or Georgia. This happened just recently where there was a senator that a woman came out of the closet and said, this guy raped me right before the election. And he lost that election. And then when everything comes out, well, he really didn't rape her. She should be put away for the charges of rape. That's it. Folks, if we start passing laws like this, then anybody that seeks to harm somebody for whatever purpose, the risk, if it is discovered that you bear false witness, that the charges you made were not true, then you get the brunt of what you basically did to that person. Because even though she knew that, you know, a statute of limitations or what have you have exceeded, that's what should happen. You know, and sadly, I do know that, you know, we have to go by the laws. And as we evolve, we're getting better and better at laws. And so there have been laws on the books, you know, with adultery, even pedophilia, even, you know, rape or statutory rape, those types of things. And I know that almost every state in the union, and probably until the 80s and 90s, actually started changing their laws and started basically saying that there are no statutes of limitation if you commit these types of crimes, which I applaud. But, you know, we can't go beyond what the laws were. In other words, because, and I say this because there was an individual, and this is really about the parties. I need to get into the parties, but there was this individual case because the laws are the laws, and they're not perfect. We need to evolve. We need to actually start recognizing that we shouldn't have statute of limitations on certain types of crimes. But there was this case where this guy was actually a child molester, and I don't know if they accused him or what ended up happening, but they came to him. They actually finally got evidence, or, you know, everything came out that this guy committed these crimes years ago in the past, and that, who knows, he may have actually committed more crimes with other kids or what have you. But it came to a point when it came out, he was actually being stood for trial. And I forget the ruling was, and you can look this up. They could not convict this man. He couldn't stand trial because the statute of limitations were in effect when the crimes were committed. And so I understand that we have that little problem, but we're now getting to a point where, you know, why is it we have statute of limitations, especially on certain crimes, sexual crimes, murder, you know, or even, you know, when somebody is actually harmed. So this is one of the things, and I'm sorry, I went down this path. It's a rat hole I went down. But the whole point is that I was talking about holding politicians and people in public accountable, especially them. And there's no statute of limitations on that. As a matter of fact, they get away with using demagoguery and hyperbole and cause harm to us all the time. We can't allow that anymore. We actually have to pass laws that say if you're a publisher, if you're a influencer, like a radio person like myself, and you're saying things that actually go down this path where you're trying to cause harm, where you have that kind of influence that enough people are listening to what you say, that, you know, the whole world heard your speech and, you know, they changed their direction or something and come to find out that was a lie, then that person really needs to be held accountable. This is, and that it's interesting how that scripture is just very clear in how to deal with that. Now, getting into the ratcheting of tyranny, bottom line, when we really look at America, you know, we were warned about the framers of a party system. Well, that was prior to the Constitution, because when we actually went into the Constitution, we ended up quickly going into two parties before the Constitution was ratified. What do I mean by that? Were they political parties that were registered? No. But they were two grassroots movements that were working in and diametrically opposed. One was for the, you know, this limited government, this limited and defined government. They were the Federalists, and they were out selling the Constitution. And those people who were a part of the big government state cabals, in other words, they wanted the state to have all the power, they really didn't care about liberty at all, because it was well documented that none of these states had bills of rights other than Virginia. And Virginia didn't have a bill of rights until it was the 1780s. Madison was in with George Mason when I think it was the first time they developed a bill of rights in Virginia. Why? Why did they start looking at the states? Because they started realizing, as Britain started treating them with these, you know, with these, I'll just say, these tyrannical laws, they realized that they needed, because they became sovereign states in the, you know, 1776 when they declared independence and said, we're now sovereign states. From that point in time and that government that they stood up, they hadn't even thought about creating bills of rights yet. So it finally evolved into the 1780s, maybe not even a decade later, where they had a convention in creating a Bill of Rights in Virginia. Many of the other states didn't care. None of the states cared, really. And it was hyperbole in some ways, maybe in Virginia. Maybe. That's speculation on my part. So as we look, going into the Constitution, we already created a two-party system. Because the big government cabals that were controlling the states, they were the anti-federalists. And they didn't want the Constitution. There were very few purists in the anti-federalist movement. In other words, they all had this motive that they didn't want to give power, this limited power, this limited and well-defined power, to this general government that was going to be created by this Constitution. They didn't want that power at all to be given. They wanted everything to stay the way it was. In other words, they were okay with the Continental Congress failing, and they were okay with whatever may have been the consequences of that. And I will tell you, this again, this is speculation, because they didn't succeed, but I believe history would have been rewritten and that we would be speaking French today, or we would be speaking some European language, had the Constitution not been ratified. And I say that because how many years after the ratification of the Constitution and the establishment of our first government was the French Revolution? And I am telling you that it wasn't until we ratified the Constitution we actually started making good on our payments, on our debt, on our war debt to the other nations, which means that in 1789, we actually made some payments out to France for probably the first time. Because what happened in 1790 was the beginning of the French Revolution. And what would have happened a couple of years later when Napoleon Bonaparte rose to power, that Napoleon Bonaparte would have looked and goes, you know, who do these snot-nosed Americans think they are? You know, they borrowed all this money from us and they haven't been good on paying us once. And instead of actually marching into Russia, he probably would have basically, you know, had a meeting with maybe Britain and said, you know what, let's divide and conquer America. We don't like what they did to you, and we definitely don't like the fact that they're not paying us, so we're going to take these parts. And, you know, and they probably would have made a deal. Who knows? They could have made a three-way deal with Spain. But there's no way they would have left us not honoring our debt. So, all things being equal, the two-party system actually reared its head before the Constitution, which is why George Washington, in his farewell address, actually started really speaking out against it, because it affected his administration. But he didn't realize that the division, you know, that he was on the wrong side of the division. In other words, the people that actually were trying to undermine the Constitution were those who actually started undermining the Constitution as a part of his administration, which was Alexander Hamilton. And he actually supported Alexander Hamilton and what he was trying to do. And he used a lot of consensus and so forth, and he really relied upon James Madison up until Jefferson and Madison parted ways with Hamilton, and Washington made the mistake of choosing to side with Hamilton. And Hamilton ended up leaving before his administration was over, so because he was, you know, he was outed with his affair or what have you. Actually, his affair, I think, actually occurred during Adams' administration. But anyway, nevertheless, I believe Hamilton did resign from the Secretary of Treasury and wanted to get back into the state because I think he had machinations of becoming the King of America. And come to find out, there's evidence that Hamilton was a spy for the British Crown. So as we start looking at, you know, and we acknowledge that we had at the very beginning a two-party system, well, let's look at how the two-party system played out in some of the tyranny, because we cannot look at the Assumption Act and violating the Constitution and assuming debt from certain states, but not others, because the other states had actually paid their debt. In other words, the Uniformity Clause does not allow the federal government to, you know, give advantages to certain states and not do that equal advantage. So in other words, let's say that, you know, out of all of the states, this is how they should have done this. And actually, the Constitution wouldn't even allow them to do this because they can't even use welfare. They can't actually do this. But let's say they said, you know, okay, we're going to make a compromise and we're not going to violate the Uniformity Clause, because that right there was just a bad message, violating the Uniformity Clause, where the federal government was able to treat certain states that had need because they still had debt gave them an advantage over the more successful states that were paying off their debt. That was a very bad message sent. But as we look at it, what they probably should have done was whoever had the greatest debt per person, then that would have been the amount of money that each state would have been credited. In other words, you know, if it, let's just say Rhode Island was the state that had the highest, then every state per person would get either a payment or a partial payment, or and Rhode Island would actually just get the debt waived. So in other words, they were going to print this money, they were going to create money, but they didn't have the money to do that. The whole point of the Assumption Act was to basically create debt to give the federal government, this was the premise, to give the federal government reasons for actually creating taxes so that they could start paying the debt and in a way implement these procedures or processes of taxation so that they would then be on the course of making money on a regular basis. Now, don't be fooled by government. Government typically does these things and they say, well, we need this much money because that's what we had to spend. No, your need fluctuates from 1 year to the next because we actually may have, you know, a war that we have to pay for. But if we downsize, we need to downsize back to the configuration of what you need to be. And that's all you need to tax us for. This idea of taxing for a rainy day, that's not in the Constitution. There are states that actually have in their Constitution, you know, a rainy day fund that they, you know, they're going to tax a little bit to create a savings so that they will be prepared for an emergency. If you want to amend the Constitution to let the federal government do that, then let's specify that, because I tell you, that's what would be in that amendment, that they could only have, you know, something of a portion of the gross domestic product, you know, the GDP, right? It's, in other words, it would be fixed to something that's, you know, we'd only have that money set aside. That's it. And that money can't be used for anything else other than the enumerated powers. It can never be spent on something that's not enumerated. Had we gone down this path, I think that, and had we not had the Bill of Rights, I honestly think we would have been far better served. But anyway, as we go into the Assumption Act, there was clearly a political party, and as a matter of fact, it was Hamilton and Madison and Jefferson at James Madison's house that created the compromise of how the Assumption Act would pass. And instead of paying everybody, it became a benefit, or the two benefactors of the Assumption Act was the state of Maryland and the state of Virginia. And nobody really knew that this was a backdoor compromise until it was actually disclosed and discussed by Jefferson himself and then Madison too. But the fact is that right there was a party compromise, and that was the first in 1790. So that's how long people have been working, and this is how I'm telling you, when you see anybody that is in our political game that has an agenda other than constitutional compliance, then we can't trust them, because they're actually working to undermine the Constitution, and their design is to literally, and I mean this, their design is to literally take away our liberties. They're punching holes in the Constitution, and that's what ends up happening. Whether they are willing to concede that or even see that, that is always what happens, and that's why we're in this mess. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.